Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 145. I'm recording it on Wednesday, June 24th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com website. The title of this selection is Corn Cob. The title of the podcast is The Candyland Explanation: Why Short-Term Timing Doesn't Work. I often talk in the podcast about why long-term timing works. The investing strategies at PassionSaving.com all assume that long-term market timing always works, that long-term market timing, in fact, is the only way to invest rationally, because in order to invest rationally, you need to take the price you're paying for the stocks you buy into consideration when you make your allocation decisions. And the only way to take price into consideration is to change your allocation in response to price changes. So if you're not engaged in market timing, long-term market timing, you're investing irrationally. You're a passive investor. And the only way to succeed in the long term is to invest rationally, that is to engage in long-term market timing. Long-term market timing is changing your allocation in response to price changes with the understanding that you may not see a benefit for doing so for, a couple years. Could even go as long as 10 years, but you at least understand it could certainly take 3 or 4 or 5 years. All right. Now, this idea is controversial. And the reason it is controversial is that the stock selling industry has spent hundreds of millions of dollars promoting the idea that quote-unquote timing doesn't work. And the thought has taken hold among people who have heard these marketing messages that no form of timing works. Short-term timing doesn't work. Long-term timing doesn't work. Short-term timing is when you change your allocation expecting to see a benefit within 6 months or a year. There is indeed evidence, lots of it, that short-term timing doesn't work. So the claim that timing doesn't work is not totally false. There's one sense of the word timing in which it's true. But the claim that timing always works is every bit as true as the claim that timing never works. It just depends on what sort of timing you're talking about. Are you engaging in short-term timing or long-term timing? One works, one doesn't. One is a smart thing to do, one is a dumb thing to do. One allows you to retire many years sooner. The other delays your retirement by many years. So we advocate long-term timing, and most of my podcasts are aimed at explaining why long-term timing doesn't work. Now, the problem that we often run into, or that I often run into, I should say, is you tell people that long-term timing works, and their minds are closed to it. Not everybody, but a good number of investors, their minds are closed to these ideas because they've heard this claim that timing doesn't work so many times, they just can't believe that we've gotten it wrong. They just say, that cannot be. I mean, that's, if there's anything I believe about investing, I believe timing doesn't work. So don't tell me that timing is the key to success. That can't be so, Rob. But it is so, I believe. So on this podcast, I've decided to attack the problem from a different direction, maybe get a fresh perspective. Instead of arguing that why long-term timing works, which I've argued on many podcasts, I'm going to try to explain why short-term timing doesn't work. Because I think the problem, the wall, the barrier that we face is that people are hung up on the fact that short-term timing doesn't work, and they transfer their skepticism about short-term timing to long-term timing. They just say, well, if short-term timing doesn't work, long-term timing must not work either. I mean, it's timing, isn't it? Well, no. The two strategies, short-term timing and long-term timing, are virtually opposite strategies. The reason why long-term timing works is the same reason why short-term timing doesn't work. So I'm going to explain, instead of trying to explain why long-term timing works, I'm going to focus on why short-term timing doesn't work. And perhaps if you come to understand why it is that short-term timing doesn't work, you will then be able to appreciate why long-term timing does, how long-term timing differs from short-term timing, and a wide variety of exciting investing strategies will be opened up to you, because it will be possible for you then to give up your belief in passive investing and become a rational investor, follower of the rational investing model, a valuation-informed indexer. That's the strategy that I recommend at the site. An approach to indexing in which you change your allocation in response to big changes in price. Now, to explain why timing doesn't work, I think it might help to go back to the very beginning of the efficient market theory. The efficient market theory is the intellectual framework for the passive investing model. The efficient market theory has been discredited. But there are many people who believe, they still sort of believe in it. They just can't give it up. And if you come to understand why the people who came up with the efficient market theory got it so wrong, that may help you to understand both why short-term timing does not work and why long-term timing does. The efficient market theory, what they were trying to understand when they came up with this theory is they were trying to explain a phenomenon that they had noticed. And the phenomenon that they noticed is that smart people who tried to beat the market were not successful. They tried all sorts of different things and they were not successful. And they concluded from that the market is efficient or rational, means essentially the same thing, that the market incorporates all information effectively. And if the market incorporates all information effectively, that essentially means the market price is the right price. Well, if the market price is the right price, you can't beat the market. Makes no sense to try to time the market. That's where all this comes from. My contention is that our knowledge of how stock investing works is primitive today. The big mistake we are making that has caused this economic crisis we're living in today is assuming that we know more than we really do. That's what's got us into a jam. If we could just start fresh, forget everything we think we know, we could have this all figured out in a short amount of time and we could set our economy straight. But we're having a hard time letting in the fact that we don't know nearly as much as we think we know, and we've got ourselves into a lot of trouble thinking we know things we really don't. The observation that lots of smart people who tried to beat the market were not able to do so was a proper and correct observation, in my opinion. And I want to use an analogy to the game Candyland to explain what I think is going on. Candyland is a very, very basic game for children. And the distinguishing characteristic of it is there's precisely zero strategy involved. It's meant for very young children. And so when you play Candyland, you just roll the dice and you move spaces. But there's nothing you can do to affect the outcome. If you're lucky, you win. If you're unlucky, you don't win. There's not a thing you can do about it. So for an adult, it's a boring game. Your mind does not get involved in it. But for a child, it's exciting because then they have a chance to win. They're equal with the adults. And they're just counting on luck. So Candyland is for very young children. Now, say that we knew nothing about the game, as we know nothing about the stock market. At least at the time we developed the efficient market theory, we knew nothing, in my view. Our knowledge is primitive. So we have this thing being played, and we notice something that that people don't seem to be able to beat it. And we're trying to figure out why. Now, say that you knew nothing about Candyland, because we know nothing about the stock market, so you don't know why it is that these smart people can't beat it. So you come up with various theories, and you say, well, you know, you start out thinking this is a game of great intelligence, which is what most people think of the stock market. They think, oh, it's got all this money, you know, it's smart people involved. So you come up with some theories, and you say, well, the thing that matters in Candyland is how old you are. Older children would obviously do better at this game because they're more developed. And so older children must do better than younger children. And you test that. And you find, huh, very interesting. Older children don't do better than younger children. Wow. What a surprise. This is what happened. They measured experts studied the stock market and found they looked at various characteristics. Is it intelligence that makes people do better? Is it experience? And none of these things checked out. So first you check out age of the child, and age doesn't affect success in Candyland. Then you say, well, maybe girls do better than boys. This is a game designed for girls that has lots of colors and all this sort of thing. It doesn't look like a boys game. Girls must do better. The key to succeeding in Candyland isn't your age. It's whether you're a girl or a boy. You check that out. You find, huh? It's not. It doesn't check out. Boys win every bit as often as girls. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with whether you're a boy or a girl. All right. Maybe it's experience. It's how many times you've played Candyland. That's it. It's not how old you are, and it's not whether you're a girl or boy. It's if you play it, you get better and better over time. Those, the winners are the ones that play a lot. Let's check that. There's our hypothesis. They could have called that the Candyland experience hypothesis. The only trouble is they checked out the hypothesis and it didn't check out. Experience has nothing to do with it. People who have played Candyland one time do just as well as those who have played it 1,000 times. Makes no difference. So they threw the Candyland experience hypothesis in the trash can. They tried lots of different things. Nothing worked. They tried IQ points. They said, well, experience doesn't do it, but maybe it's IQ points. Maybe the reason the experience thing didn't check out is some of the young kids had higher IQs. So it must be IQ points. That's how you win at Candyland. It's the IQ points. No. They checked that out. People with low IQ win just as often as people with high IQ. So they're flummoxed. What are we going to do? We cannot figure out this Candyland game. Boy, is this the toughest game to crack. Yikes, it's hard. And then some brilliant person says, I'll tell you what it is. You know how we've been trying so hard to figure out this Candyland game? Well, it's a hard game. It's the most complicated game ever invented. And what's going on is that all the people playing this game, they in order to play Candyland, obviously, from what we're looking at, you have to be highly, highly skilled. Highly, highly skilled. And they're also skilled, and they pass along all their strategies to others. And what's happening is they've all reached a point of being so highly skilled that no one, no matter how smart, no matter how experienced, doesn't make any difference. They can't get an edge. This is just a ruthless game. It's chess multiplied by 1,000. No one can ever get an edge in Candyland because the people playing it are just such tough competitors that there's no way to break in. You're never going to top the current Candyland players. If you ever found something out to give yourself a little edge, I'll tell you what would happen. These ruthless Candyland children would jump in and exploit that edge. They would jump in and that edge would be gone. Because as soon as they learn about it, as soon as they see you figured out a way to play Candyland a little bit better than they do, they're going to jump right in and that edge is going to be gone. Candyland is an efficient game. It's an efficient game. You can't get an edge. Just impossible. It's just all the information involved in winning at Candyland is incorporated into the into the knowledge base of the people playing this game. Now, did they get it right or did they get it wrong? Well, the observation is correct that no one can get an edge in Candyland. That certainly is true. But the observation is correct. The explanation is completely backwards. What these so-called experts, these scientists, have come up with is a theory that Candyland is so ruthlessly competitive that nobody can get an edge. The reality is it's not even a tiny bit competitive. It's 100% random. The people playing it are small children. They really have no idea what they're doing. They barely know how to roll the dice and move the figure. That taxes their skills. So it's not that information is being incorporated into a perfectly efficient, rational market. It's just luck. Okay? Well, that's how the stock market works in the short term. There's no ruthlessly efficient, rational market setting prices properly. In the short term, the stock market is a basket case. It's the price has no connection to reality. Sometimes it's three times fair value. We had crazy prices from January of 96 through October of 2008, nowhere even close to fair value. Not because people are ruthlessly competitive and jumping in to exploit any miscalculation, because our knowledge of stock investing is so darn primitive, we don't have a clue. And neither do they. You know, the thing they'll bring up is they'll say, oh, the people running the mutual funds, they're so smart. They don't have a clue either. The people writing the books don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. Now, what fools people, of course, is they say, well, wait a minute, Rob. You're telling me the people who run these mutual funds aren't smart? They make millions of dollars. They don't have any brains. They have brains. They're smart. They earn the money. They just don't understand how stocks work. Now, they're in good company. None of us do. None of us do until we start talking about stock investing rationally, until the passive investing era comes to an end and the rational investing model becomes dominant. We're never going to know because we can't even discuss it. We can't even talk about it. Now, what I'm saying is, that's all that the efficient market theory has going for it. People think, the efficient market theory governs everything. It governs all the advice you've been told about investing for 30 years. It governs how pension funds are invested. It governs what these bankers did. We all talk about the bankers and how we had the huge economic crisis because the bankers were not assessing risk properly. The reason they did these things is they were following the efficient market theory, which is hopelessly confused. Naturally, their risk assessments were wildly off. What would you think they would be? The people are smart. They went to school. They read the books. The books tell them the wrong thing. And they're required to follow these books. There are government laws. If they didn't follow the efficient market theory, they could get in trouble. That they're not being prudent. Okay? The problem is the phenomenon that was being studied was a real one. The thing that you can't beat the market in the short term is absolutely true, I believe. But the explanation was completely wrong. The explanation was that this means the market is ruthlessly efficient, ruthlessly rational. The reality is it's a basket case. It's completely irrational. So what you should ask yourself is, if something cannot be beaten, if it's not possible to get an edge, does that prove rationality? Does that prove efficiency? It does not. The fact that you can't beat something doesn't mean that it's rational. A perfectly good explanation of the fact that you can't beat something is it's just random. How can you beat random? The stock market in the short term is just random numbers. We shouldn't pay any attention to the price that applies in the short term. You know, you'll look at these tickers and it'll say Dow, whatever it is today, S&P, whatever it is. We shouldn't pay any attention. It is meaningless information. And what we're doing instead is we're devoting all this human energy to figuring out why did it go up 50 points? Why did it go down 23 points? It just did it. It's random. It's just like, you know, spin a wheel. The short-term price is set by investor emotion, and investor emotions obviously are not rational. It's just how people happen to feel that day. So all this gobbledygook about why the market did such and such today is meaningless drivel. And the efficient market theory says just the opposite. The efficient market theory says, no, it's not meaningless drivel. What's going on is this super complex machine is processing billions of information bits and coming to precisely the correct price within 24 hours. So don't try to beat it. You're never going to beat it, middle class investor. It's too finely tuned a machine for you to put your wits up against. It's not. It's an idiot box. It's an idiot box. That's why short-term timing doesn't work, because for timing to work, timing just means setting your allocation according to price. For timing to work, you have to be able to get an edge over the market. Passive investing is just accepting whatever the market dishes out. That's passive. Rational is trying to get an edge. And the whole appeal of passive is this idea that has been put in people's heads that you cannot get an edge. And it's a half-truth. You really can't get an edge in the short term. So in terms of should you go with short-term timing or should you go with sticking with the same stock allocation, well, in the short term, they're right. Trying to get an edge is a hopeless endeavor. But the reason for thinking you can't get an edge is totally backwards. They think it's because the market is ruthlessly processing information, and what's really going on is the market is an emotional basket case. It doesn't have a clue. It's not processing the information bits. It's ignoring all the most important information bits. The most important information bit is what is the valuation level. And most investors today don't pay any attention to that. And that's the single most important factor. So when we say, why does short-term timing not work? It's because you can't get an edge. It's because the market is so non-efficient, so non-rational, so highly emotional that there's no way to grasp it. You could have an IQ of 140. It's not going to help you. It's just nuts. You know, this is that old saying, the market can remain the market can remain non-rational? I don't recall the exact saying. The market can remain non-rational longer than you can remain solvent. You can go in and try to beat it because you notice that the market's irrational, but good luck. In the short term, you try to short the market, you're going to get killed. Because the market is not going to respond to your expectation that it should become rational. Not in the short term. Now, in the long term, that's not true. If the market were always an emotional basket case, well then investing would just be gambling. You'd just be hoping that, you know, things would come your way. But it wouldn't be investing. It would just be a pure gamble. But what makes stocks investing, what makes buying stocks investing is that the market is efficient in the long term. It is efficient in the long term. Now, basically, it takes 10 years to get to a statistically meaningful level of efficiency. In 30 years, the market is almost perfectly efficient. Not perfectly, but close enough for practical purposes. Within 10 years, the market is efficient to a statistically significant degree. In 1 year, zero efficiency. 2 years, close to zero. Now, if you have a situation where the market is wildly inefficient at one time and yet almost perfectly efficient at another time, what is the strategic implication? The strategic implication is you sure better not invest passively, because in that sort of circumstance, if you invest passively, there are going to be times when you'll be buying stocks when the price is insanely high, and then as the market works towards efficiency, you're going to be crushed in the jaws of death, as we are seeing happen today. Now, if the explanation that the people who came up with the efficient market theory came up with was accurate, if that explanation were accurate, there would be no jaws of death. If the market were efficient on the day you bought, then passive investing makes sense. You just, in that case, the value proposition would be the same at all price levels. The value proposition would always be good. Stocks really would always be best for the long term. It would make perfect sense to buy stocks at all sorts of valuation levels, to stay at the same stock allocation. But if, as I say, the market is being transformed over time from a wildly inefficient thing into a almost perfectly efficient thing, then you have to pay attention to price, because the value proposition is changing wildly. And you're going to get crushed in the jaws of death if you don't invest non-passively, if you don't invest rationally. Now, the big distinction that between short-term timing and long-term timing, and I have this happen all the time. I'll talk about long-term timing, and people will say, well, how can, you know, the sort of question you'll get is, well, how do you know the market low? Or how do you know the market high? How do you don't know when to make your changes? And when you're talking about short-term timing, that's a great question. Because if the market is just bonkersville, how could you possibly know when to pick a high or when to pick a low? There's no way to know. That's why short-term timing doesn't work. But see, when people say you can't pick highs and lows, they're not understanding why you can't pick highs and lows. The reason you can't pick highs and lows is not because the market's efficient. The reason you can't pick highs and lows is because the market is so inefficient that you can't trust anything it says. The reason you can't pick highs and lows isn't because the market price is always right. The reason you can't pick highs and lows is because the market price in the short term is always wrong. It's just basically a random number. Trying to make sense out of it is a fool's errand. You can't do it. So this is why I say, the reason why short-term timing doesn't work and long-term timing does, I should say the reason why short-term timing never works and long-term timing always works, is that they are totally opposite phenomenon. The market is totally irrational, totally inefficient in the short term, and totally rational, totally efficient in the long term. So it's two totally opposite things. So trying to time the short term is a hopeless quest, but trying to time the long term is a mandatory quest. That's the whole point of stock investing, is to know when do stocks offer a good return, when do they offer a bad return, and to invest heavily at the times they offer a good return, and not to invest heavily at the times they offer a bad return. Now, something that throws people is one of the reasons you can't do short-term timing is there's, you know, so many people have tried and failed. Why do they all fail, no matter how smart they are? It's because there's a million, well, not a million, but there's a hundred factors that come into play. You know, what's the Federal Reserve going to do in interest rates? How are gas prices going? Is there going to be a terrorist attack? Is a political leader going to be assassinated? Are we going to get out of the recession? You know, a long, 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 long list. And nobody, no human being can no computer can sort through all of these factors and figure out what the right allocation is. It just can't be done. That's why short-term timing doesn't work. So people will think, well, okay, well then long-term timing must not work. No, 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 1,000 times no. All you need to do to engage in long-term timing effectively, all you need to know are two things. You need to know the long-term value proposition of stocks. And in the U.S., that's not hard to know. In a broad index of U.S. stocks, the long-term average return has been roughly 6.5% real for a long, long time. If you don't think it's going to be 6.5% real in the future, feel free to adjust that number. If you're a pessimist, you think the U.S. has seen its best days, lower that number down to 6. If you're an optimist, increase that number up to 7. But, you know, if you're going to go into this with the thought that long-term value proposition is going to be 2, you know, or is going to be 20, you know, you're really taking a long odds bet. That's gambling in the extreme. Because it's been 6.5% for a long, long, long time. So the logical thing to do is to say, I don't know exactly what it's going to be, but my guess is somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.5. So you've got that number, 6.5. Now you need one number to make an adjustment, and that is today's valuation level. Knowing today's PE10 level, you can adjust. You can say, well, 6.5 is the average. Today we're at, if you were investing sometime between 1996 and 2008, you'd say, well, we're double fair value. We were double fair value for almost all of that time period. Today, it's not reasonable to expect 6.5, maybe something around 3. And then you can make a rational decision. You can say, well, if I get 3% in stocks and I can get tips are paying 3.5, let me think. High-risk asset class paying 3 or a low-risk asset class paying 3.5, which is the better deal? What you'll find, if you think about it just for 5 seconds, is that the low-risk asset class paying the higher return is the better deal. So knowing two things, you know all you need to know. You've got to know the long-term value proposition for stocks in the U.S., and that's that a broad index pays roughly 6.5. And you need to know the valuation adjustment. And to know that, you have to look at the PE10 level. You can go to the calculator at my website, the Stock Return Predictor, and it'll tell you. It'll perform the thing for you. If you don't feel like doing it yourself, just plug in a number. If you don't believe my numbers, check it for yourself, by all means. But that tells you the long-term value proposition of stocks. So, you know, as my friend Art at the Motley Fool Boer used to say, easy peasy. Long-term timing couldn't be any easier. People think it's hard. People hear me say, you've got to engage in long-term timing, middle-class investor, no hope if you don't do it. And they say, oh, but Rob, I'm not smart enough. John Bogle can't do it. Bill Bernstein can't do it. Jonathan Clements can't do it. You want me to do it? Rob, I don't study stocks. I don't even like numbers. I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm going to invest passively. I hate numbers. I hate numbers. But I can do it. So if I can do it, I know you can do it. Just plug in today's PE10 value into the calculator And you'll know the long-term value proposition of stocks in about 2 seconds. And then you just have to make a judgment call. You know, if the long-term value proposition is that stocks are likely to return 5% real annualized over the next 10 years, well, then you decide. Say, well, is it worth it? You might understand to get that 5% annualized, which, you know, I haven't checked the number lately that applies, but it's at least 5% real. I think it's a little higher than that. Today, if we may be seeing a big stock crash up ahead. I think we probably will be. So can you live through that? If you can't live through that and stick with your stock allocation, then, you know, you've got to get your allocation down to a level where you can live through it, through a big stock crash. And you'll have to hold on for 10 years. But if you can hold on for 10 years, at whatever allocation you pick, that's the right allocation for you. You should be going with the highest allocation you think you can go with and stick with stocks through a brutal stock crash. Stick with them for 10 years. Because in 10 years, the odds are you're going to have a good... It may not be 5% real. You can look at the calculator and see the range. But, you know, the most likely possibility is it'll be somewhere in that neighborhood. It could be a little higher, but it could be lower. But it's probably not going to be too much worse than that at the end of 10 years. Maybe a lot worse in 2 years or 3 years. But not in 10 years, it's likely to not be too much worse than that. So knowing those two numbers, you know all you need to know. You don't really need to even know the numbers. I mean, you don't need to know the 6.5 if you just use the calculator. But those are the two numbers that go into the calculation, figuring out the long-term value proposition of stocks. The two things that go into it are, what is the long-term value proposition of stocks in the U.S. of a broad index, and what is the valuation adjustment? So it's easy peasy. It couldn't be any easier. Why? What short-term timing doesn't work because that's not true of short-term timing. Short-term timing, to be an effective short-term timer, you'd have to know 1,000 different things because in the short term, stock prices are set by emotion. How are you going to do it? Are you going to go and take every investor in the United States and put them on a psychiatrist's couch and interview them for an hour and say, well, what emotions are going through your head today about stocks? How do you feel about your mother? You know, what kind of dreams have you had lately? Trying to figure out what you're going to do a month from now. In the event that stock prices fall, and in order to do this, I need to do a full psychoanalytic workup, and I need to know, well, look at this picture. What does it remind you of? I mean, you're going to have to do this not to one person. You're going to have to do it to every middle-class investor because every middle-class investor sets the price in the short term, not in the long term. In the long term, prices have to return to fair value. But in the short term, we've got the power. We can set prices wherever we want. So you're going to have to do, for short-term timing to work, you'd have to do a full psychiatric write-up of every middle-class investor in the country. And by the time you finished all those write-ups, the psychiatric profile would change. It's hopeless. If stock investing is 100% emotion in the short term, there ain't no way you can engage in short-term timing and win. But if stock investing is almost perfectly efficient in the long term, you sure can engage in long-term timing. The two are opposite phenomena. What's different is what controls price. Rationality controls price in the long term. Emotion controls price in the short term. Rationality can be calculated. Rationality lends itself to calculation. That's why long-term timing works. Emotion is a testing process. Emotion does not lend itself to calculation. See, what's happening in the short term is we're all trying as a collective entity, middle-class investors, to figure out what the price of stock should be. So we try different things. We tried, you know, in November and December, stock prices were coming down, I think January too. We were, they call it testing lows, whatever you want to call it. We were just trying things. And we're saying, is this what we think is right? Nah, it should be lower. Is this what we think? Nah, I'm still scared out of my wits. Should be lower. And then we get to a point where it's low enough and we say, well, maybe that's not the long-term low, but I think that's low enough for now. So then we say, it should be a little higher. Obama's in, you know, he's doing some good things. It should be a little higher. Let's get it up a little bit. Get it up, then we say, well, I thought he was doing good things, but I don't know. I'm getting queasy. I don't know. Somebody said something about that press conference. I don't know if he's as good as I thought. He seems like he's trying, but maybe he's not perfect. A little lower. But then if he passes health care, it's a pretty sharp guy, a little higher. Our emotions are ever changing. They change every day. They change every minute. Can't engage in short-term timing. We're setting the price of stocks by our emotion, and they change. They're ever-changing. Can't do it. But the long-term is a lock. Now, it's not, when I say it's a lock, it's not a precise lock. I can't, I can give you a precise lock, fairly precise lock. But to give you, if I was going to make, the stock return predictor tells you the most likely return, not only at 10 years, it tells you at 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 and 60. If you want a precise lock, look at the 60-year number. That's fairly precise. If you want a reasonably precise number, precise for practical purposes, look at the 30-year number. If you're looking at most people want something quicker than that. They don't want to go out 30 or 60 years. Well, if you want something quicker, look at the 10-year number, but you don't get precision. Because the 10-year number, the market's not perfectly efficient in 10 years. Efficiency starts to kick in at about 5 years. And at 10 years, you've got enough efficiency kicking in I can give you a statistically valid number, but I can't be terribly precise. So at 10 years, you have to be willing to, take a mix of factors. Now, I said early on, I compared the market to Candyland, and I said, there's nothing going on in the short term. There's no rationality. Something that will make that a little hard to believe is people will say, well, wait a minute, Rob. Now, are you telling me that the price of Campbell's soup, there's no rationality to that? No, I don't think that's true. I think there is some rationality. And the reason is because the big players in the market, the mutual fund managers and all this sort of thing, pension fund managers, if the price of Campbell's soup gets wildly out of whack of what it should be in comparison to the competitors, whatever the other soup companies are, they can engage in these complicated transactions where they set themselves up. They call it arbitrage. They know that they don't have to know. They don't know if Campbell's soup is going up or down. But they know that I'll use Apple Computer, so I don't know what the competitor to Campbell's Soup is. Say it's Kraft. Say Campbell's competing with Kraft Foods. So if you know that Campbell is overpriced in comparison to Kraft, you can set up what's called arbitrage. You're not betting. When you do an arbitrage, you're not betting that Campbell's going to go up or down. You don't know. You're not betting the Kraft is going to go up or down. What you're betting is that the price of Campbell is going to come down compared to the price of Kraft. That Campbell is overpriced in comparison to Kraft in relative terms, and that the two prices are going to come closer together. And you set up an arbitrage. And if that happens, you win. And that does go on. And because that goes on, there are limits to the extent to which Campbell can be mispriced in comparison to Kraft. I believe that that's so. It's hard to see how it wouldn't be so. So that is efficiency, that is rationality, and that is true even in the short term, not only in the long term. So this is another thing that throws people. They say, well, you're saying that there's no efficiency in the short term, but Rob, there is efficiency in the short term. The the big shots, the mutual fund managers are able to bring the price of, if the price of Campbell gets out of hand, they bring it down pretty quick with this arbitrage stuff. How about that, Rob? Well, as I say, I think that's true. But what you have to understand is there's a mechanism there in which efficiency is achieved. The mechanism is this arbitrage. There's a way to make money from quote-unquote exploiting inefficiencies. Okay? But when you're dealing with the price of the market as a whole, there is no way to make money. There are no arbitrage possibilities. If there were a way to arbitrage the fact that the overall market price is bonkers, I would be a rich man today. I have been saying since May of 2002 on public discussion boards that we were headed for a huge stock crash. And if I could have somehow bought something in the expectation of that happening, I'd be a rich man today. I wouldn't have put every dollar in it, but I would have put a lot because I was sure it was going to happen. My confidence level was very high. So I would have been happy to have invested 50% of my money in that vehicle, and I would have made, you know, that no, most people didn't think that was going to happen. So I would have been paid handsomely. I'd never have to work again. But there is no such vehicle. The closest thing that exists is called LEAPS. And it's a vehicle you can buy where you are betting on the long term price of the entire index. I think you can buy LEAPS on the S&P 500. And I explored it once. I went to my bank and asked about it. But the trouble, there's two big problems with LEAPS. One, the transaction costs are just ungodly. Even if you get it 100% right, you can barely make money because the costs are so high. If the market changed in the next month, you would get a big payoff. But the costs are very high. And the other thing was, it was very hard to go out far. About the farthest I could go out when I checked into it was about 2 years. And I can't predict stock returns 2 years out. So LEAPS don't help you. You have to be able to go out a minimum of 5 years and preferably 10 years. A minimum of five. Even at five, it'd be a high-risk bet to buy LEAPS. But you might get a payoff. But 2 years, 3 years, no. Can't be done. It's short-term. So there is no mechanism by which smart people can, quote-unquote, exploit inefficiencies in the prices of stocks. Relative inefficiencies, yes. Campbell Soup versus Kraft, yes. There's a way to do it. The level of the S&P being wildly wrong? No, there's no way to do it. So there's no reason to believe that the reason why there's no reason to believe that efficiency is in operation in the market. There's just no reason to believe in that explanation. It's true that we can't get an edge on the market in the short term, but there's no reason to believe that that's because of efficiency or rationality. It's just because of randomness. There's simply no way to beat a random market. So the only way we can beat the market is through long-term timing. You know, I mean, obviously you can beat it if you learn how to do this arbitrage stuff, but that's incredibly complicated stuff. It'll take you a lifetime to learn. But long-term timing is easy peasy. All you have to do is lower your stock allocation when prices get insanely high and increase it when prices get insanely low, and you're set. And the calculators at the website show you, by making that one change, investing rationally rather than passively, you can retire 5 years sooner. That's how big a difference this makes. That's how inefficient the market is today. That's how irrational the market is today. Another way to think about it, why can't we engage in short, why doesn't short-term timing work? What matters in terms of short-term timing is the return sequence that comes up. And there's hundreds of them. You can go to the calculators and test how many return sequences there are. How are you going to know which one's going to come up? That's what matters in the short term. In the long term, what matters is the value proposition. What sort of productivity is the economy generating? And that's a there's really only one thing you need to know, and that's, is the U.S. going to remain as productive as it has been in the past? If you're willing to make a bet that it is, you're set. Long-term timing works. You only need to know that one thing. Now, is there a guarantee that's going to happen? No. could be the U.S. is going to collapse. If the U.S. collapses, long-term timing is going to be a bust. But of course, if the U.S. collapses, passive investing is going to be a bust too. So you don't have too many options in that event. If you're not willing to put your faith that the U.S. economy is going to survive, then you've got a problem. But if you're willing to take that bet, long-term timing is the way to go. So, you know, essentially, passive is doing the same thing. Passive indexing is doing the same thing. It's taking the 100 factors that affect short-term results and saying, we're only going to look at one. We're going to boil this all down. Instead of trying to figure out 100 different things, which is what you have to do to make short-term timing work, what we're going to do as conventional indexers is say, no, you really only need to know one thing. All you need to know is how productive is the economy likely to be? Are U.S. stocks going to perform somewhat as they always have in the past? And if they do, you're set. But the error, the fatal error of the passive investors is there are two factors you have to look at, whether the U.S. economy is going to perform as it always has and the valuation adjustment. They looked at one, and they ignored the second. And they ignored it because of this mixed up idea as to why short-term timing doesn't work. They went by the theory that short-term timing doesn't work because there's all this ruthless exploitation going on. The market has the price perfect. And what's really going on is that the market has the price wildly influenced by emotion. And the market has the price wildly wrong, not wildly right. And so what they're doing is, their conclusion was, go ahead and invest at times of insane overvaluation and you won't pay a price for it. And the reality is just the opposite. The trend towards efficiency is going to crush you if you invest it passively. What you have to do to boil everything down to one number, which is what you want to do if you're a middle-class investor and you don't want to have to spend your whole life studying investing, is make it not one number but two numbers. Make it the long-term return for stocks, 6.5, plus a valuation adjustment. And then it works. Then this wonderful approach to investing that John Bogle tried to share with us in the late 1970s when he found that Vanguard works, if just you'll apply that valuation adjustment. But if you don't apply it, then what happens is you get crushed because you're not investing rationally. You're not adjusting for valuations. You're over-investing in stocks at times of insanely high prices, and you're under-investing in stocks at times of insanely low prices. Now, the last point I wanted to make is the key to success is being able to the way I think about it is actionable information. You have to have actionable information. The reason short-term timing doesn't work is that there's no actionable information. There's 1,000 things you can look at. You know, as I said, what's the Fed going to do on interest rates? Is there going to be a terrorist attack? Is the president going to succeed? There's a million things that affect the emotions of investors and therefore affect the price of stocks in the short term. So it's 1,000 things. The reason short-term timing doesn't work is that 1,000 is too many. You can't process. The information is not actionable. How does long-term timing differ? Long-term timing differs in that there's only one thing you need to know. If you know the value, if you know the PE10 level, you got it. You got it solved. The 6.5 number always stays the same, so you don't really need to know that. It's just a stable. And then you need to make that adjustment, that adjustment for valuation. And all you need to do is plug in today's PE10 value into the stock return predictor, and it spits it out at you, and you got it. That's all you need to know to invest effectively for the long term. So the way it works is, the way to think about it is, whenever you're thinking of an investing strategy, is this strategy going to work or not? Think about how many things have to go right for me to get it right. How many things have to go right for me to get it right? To engage in short-term timing, say that you're the smartest person on earth, and you figure out just what the Federal Reserve is going to do it, the exact day they're going to do it, and you figure out exactly how quick the stimulus is going to take to work, and you figure out exactly whether healthcare is going to pass or not, and you figure out exactly what gas prices are going to be for the next 3 years. You're like a super genius, kajillion marble lana genius. You know everything. And PTAT always has worked. We've looked at the historical data. It always has worked. Common sense tells us it must work. The rational human mind isn't able to imagine a scenario in which it doesn't work. Now I'm going to leave you with one last thought. When I say it must work, does that mean every valuation-informed strategy works? No. Something you should always keep in mind if you become a valuation-informed indexer is the percentage possibility of it working varies depending on how bold your bets are. So this is why I don't recommend bold bets. I never recommend going with a zero stock allocation or 100% stock allocation for the average investor. Now, different people have different circumstances, and there might be circumstances. I went with a zero stock allocation in 96 because my circumstances were I couldn't afford big losses because of my personal circumstances. So I felt zero was right for me, but I wouldn't recommend it for many others. But you have to look at, in trying to determine how likely is your strategy going to work, and this is why I say what I call rational investing, I think in time will come to be called probability investing. Because rational investing is looking at the probabilities. I call it rational investing to contrast it with passive, which is irrational, not looking at price. But ultimately, what you're doing as a rational investing is looking at probability. So I want to give you just a couple of examples of how looking at the way in which you engage in valuation-informed indexing changes the likelihood of success. We're at a P10 level of 14, fair value, and you determine that your proper stock allocation is 70% stocks, 30% tips, let's say. Now, over time, the P10 level rises to 44, where it was in January of 2000, the highest point it's ever been in history. Say that you consider lowering your allocation from 70% stocks to 60% stocks at a P10 level of 44. What are the odds that that will help you in the long term? Well, I didn't do a scientific analysis here, but I'll just tell you the odds that a move from 70% stocks to 60% stocks when the P10 level has gone from 14 to 44, I'd say the odds of that producing a good result are at least 9,999 out of 10,000. In other words, the odds of a bad result are less than 1 in 10,000. That is as close to a lock as you can get here on planet Earth. As close to a lock as you can get here on planet Earth. Now, say that you start it with a 70% stock allocation at a P10 level of 14, fair value. And now the P10 level has gone to 18. It's a little higher. Not insanely high, not even dangerously high. But not obviously 18's higher than 14. And the thing you're considering is not going from 70% stocks. You're thinking of to 60%. You're thinking of dropping down to 50% stocks, 20% drop. What are your odds there of a bad result as a result of that change? Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I think that's a hard call. I haven't done a scientific analysis, but if you're at a P10 level, if the P10 level has only gone up 4 points and you're talking about a 20% drop in allocation, I would say the odds of a bad result are probably equal to the odds of a good result. Maybe worse. I'd say the odds of a bad result are probably better than 50 in 100. Better than 50%. Because you're overreacting. That change in P10 level is not that significant, and you're making not a huge change in allocation, but a significant change. So the point here is, if you want to get the best result possible with valuation-informed indexing, you might make a lot of changes. But you have to understand, as you get fancy, the odds of success, the odds of valuation-informed indexing being a plus go down. They diminish. The more fancy you get, the more they diminish. If you only change your allocation at the extremes, this strategy is sure to pay off. Sure to pay off. If you start, getting tricky, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. And of course, there's all sorts of in-betweens. There's all sorts of in-betweens. So the whole thing is you don't want to ignore price. That's dogmatic. That's passive. That's crazy. That's irrational. That's dangerous. You don't want to become a dogmatic passive. But you don't want to become a dogmatic valuation-informed investor either. You don't want to say, I'm going to change my allocation. Last week the P10 level was 15. This week it's 16. I'm dropping my allocation right away. That's Looney Tunes. That's just as Looney Tunes as investing passively. You've got to think a little bit about, am I improving my situation or am I not? Am I sure I'm improving it? Or is my confidence, am I sort of thinking maybe I'm improving it, but my confidence isn't very high? It's up to you how many changes you make. That's a judgment call. But what I can tell you is what you're trying to do in having success is to figure out the odds. And you can't figure it out with precision. You just want to use a little common sense. But common sense tells you, you sure better make a change when the price of stocks is 3 times fair value. But when it's only gone up a little bit, I say no, you shouldn't make a change. And of course, there's in-betweens. And at the in-betweens, it's more of a judgment call. But again, you don't have to worry about making those judgment calls on any one particular date. You don't have to pick tops. You don't have to pick bottoms. That's why the reason why short-term timing doesn't work is that you do have to pick tops and bottoms. Short-term, by its nature, has a deadline on it. You've got to make your changes within this specified period of time. Long-term, no, there's no deadline. You could have changed your allocation in a downward direction anytime from January 96 through October of 2008. And received a benefit for doing so. You had 12 years. That's how easy long-term timing is. So all the things that cause short-term timing not to work cause long-term timing to work. They're opposite strategies. I hope that helps in explaining the difference between short-term timing and long-term timing, and also in highlighting the original mistake that caused all this mixed-up thinking on stocks that got us into the jam we're in today, the mixed-up thought that because smart people were not able to get an edge in the short-term, that somehow that told us that the market is efficient in the short-term. It told us no such thing. What it really told us, the true explanation for the fact that you can't get an edge in the short-term is that the market is nutso in the short-term. The market is totally inefficient in the short term, totally emotional, that there's nothing to this efficient market / passive investing stuff at all. It's just the reality is the opposite. The reality is not that the timing is a bad idea. The reality is that timing is required for long-term success, only you better make sure it's long-term timing and not short-term timing. Good luck with your investing strategies.